Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
The Case of East Asia. Jonathan Fenby. East Asia is usually viewed in economic terms as a motor of global growth and home to the manufacturing and trading prowess of China, Japan, South Korea, and the developing nations of the ASEAN region. But overlying this familiar story is one of the most complex set of geopolitical factors on Earth. It involves both regional and global actors as nationalisms compete against a politically potent backdrop of history. Strong leaders with embedded national narratives and ambitions confront one another. The United States faces deep questions about maintaining the strategic umbrella it has provided since the end of the Second World War, while the rising power of the reborn Middle Kingdom sees no need to conform to the global order that has provided the framework for its ascension or to be a great power with which others are comfortable. Taken together, developments in East Asia in the present decade make up a key element for global geopolitical stability, or instability, with important geoeconomic fallout. To take the main elements. 1. In 2011, the Obama administration announced what was known as the Pacific Pivot to step up the post-1945 US commitment to East Asia, where it has treaty allies in Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines, as well as major economic interests and connections. 2. At the same time, China started to assert its sovereignty claims in the South and East China Seas, which had been left on the shelf while the People's Republic, PRC, kept to Deng Xiaoping's advice that it should hide its brilliance and bide its time as it concentrated on building up its economic strength. 3. Both great powers have increased their military activities in the South China Sea, a major global maritime route, as well as containing energy reserves and rich fishing grounds. In 2016, the US deployed an aircraft carrier group in the area and sent destroyers to exercise freedom of navigation near reclaimed reefs on which China has built a string of bases, some deploying missile batteries. Shortly afterwards, in June, the PRC carried out its biggest live-fire drills to date with warships, fighter jets, and submarines off the disputed Paracel Islands. 4. China stakes its claims mainly on the basis of a map dating from 1947, before the communists won power, which shows its sovereignty extending along a nine-dash line that covers most of the sea. The Philippines, Vietnam, Brunei, and Malaysia have conflicting claims, while Indonesia fears that the PRC has designs on its Natuna Islands, and to the north, Beijing and Tokyo are locked in a dispute over the uninhabited Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. The Japanese report rising Chinese aerial and maritime activity in the area as the two countries play out the latest act in a struggle for regional influence dating back to the end of the 19th century. 5. After being named as the PRC's leader at the end of 2012, Xi Jinping enunciated a China dream of national rejuvenation and strengthening, which included a military build-up, a higher global profile, and power projection in East Asia. 6. Since starting his second term as Prime Minister of Japan, a month after Xi took over as General Secretary of China's Communist Party, Shinzo Abe has set out to spread the regional influence of his country and to dismantle some of the military restrictions placed on it by the post-war pacifist constitution. Opinion polls show declining public opposition to such a change, and Abe solidified his position with his party's victory in Senate elections in July 2016, though he said he would put economic measures first. 7. North Korea has been testing nuclear weapons and missiles on which to mount them since 2006. Pyongyang claimed a test at the beginning of 2016 was of a hydrogen bomb, though Western experts doubt this was the case. In response, South Korea is working with the US on an anti-missile system known as Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, THAAD, which it had previously rejected. 8. China and Russia have strengthened their political, strategic, and economic links with a series of top-level talks, joint military maneuvers, and big commercial deals involving supplies of gas to the PRC, and Chinese infrastructure projects such as a 90-kilometer high-speed railway line as the first stage of a Moscow to Beijing train link. 9. Military spending is increasing significantly in the region, led by China as it develops its navy and air and missile forces, but also by Vietnam, plus 7.6% in 2015, Indonesia, plus 16%, and the Philippines, plus 25%, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. 10. The sweeping victory of the autonomous-minded Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, in presidential and legislative elections in Taiwan at the beginning of 2016 looks likely to aggravate relations with mainland China after 8 years of rapprochement under the island's previous Kuomintang, KMT, administration. Beijing reacted by cutting off official communications and is likely to scale back economic links. That list makes plain the way in which East Asia is home to two potentially combustible geopolitical elements: US-China rivalry and a patchwork of sovereignty disputes involving almost all the countries in the region. The first has given rise to speculation that it may be the scene for the latest installment of the Thucydides trap, in which the principal rising and status quo powers come into conflict. According to Graham Allison of Harvard, open warfare has usually been the outcome, as between Athens and Sparta, France and Britain in the 18th and early 19th centuries, or Germany and the Allies arrayed against it in two world wars. The second has underlined the potent nature of national rivalries and ambitions, often with deep historical roots, as between China and Japan, which first went to war in 1894 to 1895, followed by Japan's invasion and brutal occupation of nationalist-led China between 1931 and 1945. China invaded Vietnam in 1979, but its army was obliged to withdraw after it ran into sturdy resistance. The absence of a regional system to settle disputes aggravates the situation. China sometimes gives the impression of thinking that its sheer size entitles it to have its own way. A senior diplomat said last year that countries like the Philippines just had to get used to the fact that they were small and China large. China's assertion of its interests has been fanned by what Beijing sees as the equivalent of Cold War containment of the Soviet Union. There is a striking contrast between the American network of treaties and defense agreements, with Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and the Philippines, plus a rapidly developing relationship with Vietnam, and China's preference for dealing with issues on a one-off bilateral basis. Washington says it is simply part of a rules-based system which wants to ensure freedom of navigation in the region's seas, the promotion of economic growth, free trade, and multilateralism. But Beijing has never been ready to submit to international supervision, as it showed by refusing to take any notice of the ruling in July 2016 by a group of judges under a United Nations tribunal who found that its nine-dash-line claim was invalid and that it contravened a United Nations Convention on Maritime Law. The tribunal also decided that the PRC was not entitled to an exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, extending up to 200 nautical miles from one of the islands it claims in the Spratlys archipelago. China denied the tribunal's jurisdiction in advance. Wang Yi, the foreign minister, called the case a farce and added that Chinese people will not accept the result, and all people around the world who uphold justice will not accept the result. In the days preceding the judgment, the PRC staged its big naval exercise as if to show that whatever the tribunal might decide, it was intent on pursuing its power projection in the region as it followed the policy of using the reef constructions to create facts on the ground, or in this case, in the water. As China expands regionally, the Obama administration's drive to create a Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, of free trade among a dozen nations, has been a particular irritant to the PRC since it is excluded by the conditions laid down for membership. The plan has been approved by governments, but still faces legislative hurdles. It was attacked by both Democratic and Republican candidates in the 2016 US presidential election campaign as a threat to American jobs. Chinese diplomats point to the scheme's name as implicit backing for their argument that, while it is a Pacific power, the US is not an Asian nation and so should stay out of that continent. Not surprisingly, the TPP is seen in Beijing as a further brick in the containment wall, and the Xi administration has been busy promoting a series of regional schemes of its own, which add geoeconomics to the political mix. The largest of them, the One Belt, One Road initiative, offers hundreds of billions of dollars in development aid to other Asian countries, though the timescale and practicability of the projects remains to be seen. More immediately, Beijing launched a $100 billion Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, in 2015, which was joined by more than 50 countries, including European nations, despite calls by Washington to stay clear. Its first projects included a $217 million investment to improve life in slums in Indonesia, a roads plan in Tajikistan, and a scheme to bring electricity to 2.5 million rural homes in Bangladesh. Then there is also a Silk Road Fund, bankrolled by China and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, grouping together the PRC, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, as well as the practical problems of pouring huge amounts of aid into states whose financial systems are ill-equipped to handle them, the potential geopolitical problems involved in this move westwards are evident. Central Asia is riven with national rivalries and disputes over such key issues as water, while Russia's short-term appetite for funding from its eastern neighbour may run into more fundamental questions of spheres of influence, as well as hard bargaining from the PRC, which has been evident in negotiations over major gas supply contracts and Chinese investments in energy assets in eastern Siberia. The higher international profile, adopted under Xi Jinping to enable China to match its economic weight with a global political role, has had its impact well outside the region, with promises of aid and investment not only in the traditional stamping grounds of hard commodity suppliers, but also in projects promised by Beijing to countries stretching from Britain to the Andean nations. But it is close to home that the impact of China's new geopolitical stance is felt most, and not always with results Beijing can relish. The expansion into the South China Sea has led countries to draw closer to the US strategic umbrella based on warships and aircraft with their headquarters in Japan. Abe's drive to relax the military limitations of the post-war constitution has drawn succor from the threat Japan perceives from the People's Republic. Beijing's failure to rein in its little brother across the border in North Korea has led South Korea towards adopting the THAAD anti-missile system promoted by America for North Asia, which China sees as part of a policy of containment as its radar penetrates deep into PRC territory. Beijing thinks Japan will join the system, and Chinese commentators believe that the PRC will probably consider developing more advanced missiles as a countermeasure. Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin denounced the THAAD system at a summit in the summer of 2016, while Foreign Minister Wang Yi said it would undermine the security interests of China and Russia, shatter the regional strategic balance, and trigger an arms race. To bolster itself against China after a series of clashes over disputed islands, Vietnam received President Obama on a state visit in 2016 and obtained a lifting of the US arms embargo to enable it to buy weapons to add to a submarine fleet it has ordered from Russia. China can usually count on a friendly power, Cambodia, to veto any critical motions in the consensual ASEAN organization. But there is no doubting the concern that has been fanned in the area by China's power projection and fears that it is trying to recreate a modern form of the imperial tributary system. China's regional and global policy certainly strikes a strong nationalist chord at home, promising to replace the century of humiliation at the hands of foreigners and the decades of an international low profile under Deng and his successors, with a resurgent China making its weight felt. The military build-up in recent years is pitched in terms of returning to former greatness on land and sea, as well as in the air, even if, except for a brief period in the early 15th century, China was a land power that did not bother itself with the sea in the manner of European empires. At a big military parade in Beijing in 2015, the message of military projection was evident when the official commentators told the crowd that missiles on show could sink aircraft carriers across the Pacific. Since becoming chairman of the Central Military Commission in 2012 and then commander-in-chief of the People's Liberation Army, PLA, in 2016, Xi has overhauled the command structure, promoted younger generals, and pressed for modernization, particularly of the Navy, aviation, the missile force, and cyber weapons. The US remains far ahead in the size of its naval and air forces and in its technology and command coordination. But China has identified the military as an arm of its party state that is central to Xi's narrative of national renewal. That may be seen, in part at least, as a means of arousing public support at home, but it also raises the old question for armed forces under a determined leader of, what are these weapons for if we are not going to use them? This question is all the more pertinent given the patriotic education adopted by the regime since the 1990s. This reinforces the nationalist climate and also chimes in naturally with the strand of thinking never far from the surface, which holds the Middle Kingdom to be an exceptional country which fell on hard times at the hands of unscrupulous foreigners, a true enough proposition, though ignoring China's own contribution to its long period of decline, and which now faces an equally reprehensible group of powers bent on preventing it from assuming its due place in the world. The education program has been aimed primarily at Japan over its behavior between 1931 and 1945, for which Beijing insists that it has not properly apologized. Official media in the PRC thunder out denunciations of Abe and his government, while the authorities seem able to turn anti-Japanese demonstrations on and off at will. As a result, some big Japanese companies have been re-evaluating their investment plans on the mainland, though this, it must be said, is also motivated by rising costs and increased competition from domestic products in a slowing economy. Few Chinese have anything good to say about the Japanese, even if they drive Hondas and take their families to Disneyland in Tokyo. Their hostility, fueled by the Abe government's plans to build up the military and its resistance to Chinese claims to the disputed islands. Approaching the end of his first five-year term in late 2017, Xi has fashioned a commanding position for himself as the helmsman of what he claims to be a national revival that will earn China the respect it deserves. As well as leading the monopoly political party, he is state president, head of the military, and holds more than half a dozen other senior posts. He has used a protracted extra-legal campaign to strengthen the Communist Party and root out corruption to eliminate real or potential foes and what he calls cabals and conspirators. Internationally, he makes plain that he sees China's proper role as equality with the United States. The irony is that this comes just as the growth in the world's second largest economy is slowing amid serious economic problems such as high debt levels and enormous excess capacity in state industries. The ambitious economic reform program laid out by the Communist Party at the end of 2013 has largely stalled. Measures designed to pump up the stock market and make currency policy more flexible have been hit by inefficient implementation. Xi's bottom line of strengthening central political power and his own authority ahead of the key party congress at the end of 2017 is preventing the economic changes the PRC needs, since they involve liberalization and opening up of the state sector, which would devolve that power. Environmental problems arising, with air, water, and soil pollution, and growing public anger at them, especially among the politically important second-generation urban middle class. China is not going to collapse economically. Forecasts to that effect over the past 15 years have been well wide of the mark, but it faces a period of growing uncertainty with the danger of being caught in a middle development trap, in which political caution and regime protection prevents it achieving its true potential. There is a historical parallel for this in the conservatism of the late Qing dynasty in rejecting modernization and preserving the position of the Manchu elite. If that happens, the geopolitical question will be whether Xi, who is set to rule until 2022, turns increasingly to regional policy and rivalry with the United States as a means of buttressing Communist Party authority. Economic growth has been the party's main claim to popular legitimacy since Deng launched economic reform, albeit while retaining authoritarian political power and preserving state monopolies in industry, transport, telecommunications, and other key fields. If that starts to fade, and issues such as the environment, food safety, and legal controls fray the links between the party and the citizens whose best interests it claims to represent, then nationalism could be summoned up to fill the breach. The danger, therefore, is that the geopolitics of East Asia may spill over into heightened confrontation powered by nationalism and rhetoric, and by the arms build-up of many countries in the region. It is not only from China that this threat looms, though sections of official media on the mainland have regularly used extreme language to warn that countries like the Philippines had better get used to the sound of Chinese guns. The increased militarization has spread across the whole region, together with a pattern of offensive-defensive statements from governments. The Abe government exploits Japanese sentiment about resuming a larger regional role. Vietnamese hostility to China has deep historical roots. Before he stepped down in 2016, the former president of the Philippines, Benigno Aquino, appealed to popular feeling against Chinese reef building, which he compared to the expansion of Germany in the 1930s. East Asia will continue to be vital to global economic health. A serious slowdown in China or a failure of Abenomics would be major impediments to restoring stronger growth. But alongside the economics, the geopolitics of the region is set to take on ever-increasing importance. The prospect of military confrontation remains limited, if only because conflict would bring economic costs, especially in disruption of trade that would outweigh any other advantage. But China has become a game-changer on a scale nobody should ignore. Having benefited from the existing order as globalization promoted by the West enabled its economic rise, it now feels able to stand aside from or challenge that global order it did not create, defining itself in relation to itself rather than to those states around it. Added to the rising distrust between the nations involved and the lack of communications between them, this makes the region a growing risk factor in an already complex world of old themes in new guises.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.